for Peace and Justice, coming up Sunday, August 21st. He has an interesting background. We thought we would spend quite a bit of time talking about the European Union, the Brexit, though he worked from 1989 to 2008 with the Commission of the Bishops, Conferences of the European Communities. He was Secretary General in Brussels to project Christian values in the European process. So we thought, I thought that we would start a conversation with how Brexit will affect Northern Ireland and Ireland, and we'll branch into all kinds of topics as we have a tendency to do. Mike Brady will be joining us a little bit later. Mike has been working with Irish Fest for a number of years, and he has been co-president of the Milwaukee Ulster Project, which we also wanted to talk about some, bringing Protestant and Catholic teenagers from Northern Ireland to Milwaukee, other cities as well, to spend a month. And it's been going on for many, many years. And my understanding is that a lot of people who have been in that project have entered the ranks of government and agencies working for the betterment of all people in Northern Ireland. Bishop Traynor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
First time in Milwaukee.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome.
Yes, it's my first time in this part of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I'm somewhat familiar with the East Coast, particularly with the West Coast, California, where I've got family and relatives.
Oh.
But this is my first visit to the Midwest, let's call it.
Yeah, well, it's the heartland, and you're going to have a rip-roaring good time. Because Irish Fest is also terrific. You'll have a very good time.
So it is. I've heard a lot about it, yeah.
Yeah. So this involvement that you had in Brussels is interesting, and you were there for a long period of time. So you must have followed and have a response either for or against what happened with the Brexit vote, which I've read is going to have repercussions for Northern Ireland and also for Ireland. Did the vote surprise you?
Yes, it surprised many. Many people woke up on that June 24th morning to surprise, in some cases I understand from some people to shock, a result which many had not anticipated or foreseen or expected. Nonetheless, personally, I felt that the outcome was always going to be a very narrow one.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally felt unable to predict the outcome because of my previous experience of referendums in the Republic of Ireland and in, for example, Denmark, and also given the outcome in a more recent referendum in the Netherlands, where a trade agreement between the European Union and the Ukraine had been put to referendum and where the outcome was a negative outcome. That's about a particular matter of a trade agreement. But the fact is that referendums are very, let us say, difficult instruments for deciding matters of immense complexity. Surprise, yes, because as many people went to bed following the process of participation in the referendum throughout the United Kingdom, at a certain point early in the morning, one of the leading figures in the pro-Brexit, in other words, Leave campaign, had remarked that he felt that the vote was going to go marginally in the direction of remaining. At dawn, as you know, the outcome was otherwise.
Yeah.
The result in the United Kingdom was 51.9% to leave, 48.1% to stay. In Northern Ireland, the outcome was 44.2% to leave and 55.8% to remain.
And so that some have called, mostly I guess Sinn Féin has called for this, for that this would immediately demand a vote on whether or not Northern Ireland should unite with Ireland, because it creates a whole set of problems with borders and people who are working who are from Ireland going to work in Northern Ireland and Irish working in England, etc. Does it immediately call for a vote on reunification or not?
Well, clearly that's a matter for politicians to consider, to debate, and then to put to public opinion. But I think that before ever one would reach that point, significant discussions and negotiations are going to have to take place. First of all, the negotiations between the United Kingdom, as made up of England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, negotiations between the United Kingdom and the European Union must begin.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the forthcoming weeks, the President of the European Council, that is the European Council of the EU, of the European Union, Mr. Tusk, will come to hold some talks with the Prime Minister, the Taoiseach of the Republic of Ireland, Mr. Enda Kenny, and will also engage in discussions with the new Prime Minister of England, of the United Kingdom, Mrs. May. And the parameters, if you like, for the negotiations need to be set in place. These negotiations need to begin with the United Kingdom. And then, I think, at a much later stage, one has to begin to look at the arrangements that will come into place. Clearly, repercussions of this decision, Mrs. May has said Brexit is Brexit. They are significant and serious at a host of different levels. At the economic level, the level of trade, at the level of everyday life across the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. At the level also of probably constitutionality within the United Kingdom. And clearly also, I think, in terms of public consciousness and cultural self-awareness, which is a dimension of this matter which has not received much attention.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard? You spent a lot of years working with the European Union in Brussels. Did all the countries come together and have a really hard time giving up a national identity to form something that was entirely different? Has that been a hard thing to accomplish?
Well, this is something which has been accomplished and has been achieved over several decades.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, the European project, which has consolidated itself in the form of the European communities, sometimes referred to as the common market, become the European Union, is something which has taken a long time from the post-war period right up to modern day times. So the coming together first of six sovereign states, then of 9, 12, 15, and now 28, has been a long and complex process.
Mm-hmm.
It is a process which was initiated within the immediate post-war context of a ruined Europe, which had experienced, you know, within a short number of decades, the First World War, the Second World War, and at the end of the 19th century, other wars. So it was a post-war development, number one. Secondly, it was a process which emerged in a context in which many of these countries had been immensely impoverished by all kinds of factors, not only war but also the Depression, where there were high levels of unemployment, high levels of emigration, and so on. Countries which, you know, which were almost mortal enemies, France and Germany. So intense negotiations did take place, and very difficult decisions were taken in the early 50s prior to the signing of the Coal and Steel Treaty, prior to the signing of the Treaty of Rome in 1957. But slowly but surely, the architecture, the institutions of the European communities were set in place. These were the high authority, the European Commission, now it's called, which, if you like, was responsible for promoting the common good, the common European interest, representing, if you like, the vision and the aim and of the project.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Parliament, which in 1979, the European Parliament became directly elected every 5 years by the peoples of the member states. And, of course, the Council of Ministers representing the governments of the member states, the 6, the 9, the 12, the 15. And what was new in this was, of course, that not only that you had the establishment of these institutions and, of course, the Court of Auditors and the Court of Justice in Luxembourg, but you had the decision freely, and this is very important, to freely and voluntarily decide to pool a certain amount of national sovereignty and to share it with other member states for a common purpose. And the common purpose was first and foremost the achievement of peace, the consolidation of peace, and the promotion of peace between countries which had been erstwhile enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were, of course, interests at play in all of this. It is evident that It was of immense and particular interest to France to ensure that, you know, Germany could somehow or other be bound in to some kind of, you might say, common project. But anyway, that was the first thing, the pooling of national sovereignty on the basis of agreed principles and rules, the establishment of arenas of competence, which would be...
Competence.
Okay. And that, of course, is something which has been developed over the years. Then the European Parliament. So the Commission, if you like, making the ball, kneading the ball and throwing it in. Throwing it in to, for the consideration and the kneading by the member state governments, their representatives, and by the Parliament, the representative of the institution representing the people of Europe. This, of course, developed then the what is commonly referred to as the... community method, the community way of making policy and of taking decisions. Mm-hmm. It's long, it's complex. It is something that was totally new at the supranational level, a new level between the national and the international. It has had immense difficulties and trials. It has been a very ambitious project. The treaty has had to be developed over the years. And it has evolved, for example, with the Single European Act, the Treaty of Maastricht, the Treaty of Amsterdam, the Lisbon Treaty. Mm-hmm. But as time passed, of course, we have in Europe, as you have here, experienced all kinds of contextual trials and problems. We have had the great oil crisis in the middle of the 1970s. We have had just to take it very simply, the experience of 2008 and afterwards, the financial crisis. We've had the intensification of the process of globalization. We have seen the emergence of, again, as was the case in the 30s and the 40s, high levels of unemployment, the delocalization of production to cheaper producing countries, impacting unemployment, that in turn impacting upon the prospects for youth, necessitating urgent and new imaginative efforts on the part of those entrusted with governance in our societies and in our institutions. We have seen then in more recent years, alas, the emergent new or newly intense tensions between the West and the rest, as one of your commentators talked about in this country in the early 1990s. The rise of efforts in a world of easy communications, of the immediate technological capacity for communication. We mm-hmm. have seen the rise of the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. We have seen the wars in the Middle East and the impact of all of this on not only politics, but on the public mind and on public discourse. And that has brought about a context in which you have had all of these factors of rising unemployment, exclusion, you have migration, you have the prospect of what kind of relations will pertain within the human family, and how do those entrusted with political authority and responsibility respond to this in this age of what one might call a new anxiety and fear.
And so, when
the result of that is quite simple, that in that context, we have seen in Europe the rise of, parties and individuals on the extremes.
Yeah.
And in the face of that, the European project is in urgent need, I believe, of some recalibration yet again.
Yeah. So when you talk about the common good, I mean, that's a nice phrase, the common good, because I think that we've forsaken a common good in many other countries as well. Is there something that's making people, is it because of the, it's been played as a migration issue by many in this country, that people were worried about the influx of people coming in from Arab states that have failed or are undergoing incredible war and people have to flee and they're dying in boats, but Europe is a little bit worried about taking in a new group of people in large numbers. Was it an anti-immigrant, an anti-migrant vote that took place here, that somehow the common good, we had to change what our definition was of the common good and it didn't include these people, or we wanted to go back because we're worried about migration to our own unit? What happened to the common good is my question.
Yes, well, The going back to Brexit, which you have mentioned, I believe that the reasons for the dominance of the no vote are manifold and numerous. Migration and fear of migration is certainly was one, named by many people who were interviewed after the vote.
Mm-hmm.
The rise of unemployment and the fear for the employment of young people in the future is another. Probably as well, subliminally, there is the question in many people's minds, is there a pilot in the aircraft in the face of these globalization processes? And as well as that, as far as the United Kingdom is concerned, and specifically the vote in England and Wales, I believe that the question of the relationship between a perceived elite in London and the ordinary person in the streets of the cities and towns and villages of the countryside, this gap. I think that these are all factors which played into the no vote. In terms of your question about the common good and the good of all and migration, clearly the migration question, migrants and refugees and those seeking asylum, is the question of our time. And we do have, as a first world, as first world countries, we do carry with us not only the burdens, but also the responsibilities of our past history and of our various forms of engagement in what we refer to as third world countries. In other words, in countries which are developing countries. And I believe that we do, in today's world, have to develop almost a new global social ethic in terms of the development of peoples. And this has been a train and element of significant thought in the social thinking and teaching of the Catholic Church for many, many years, intensified from the end of the 19th century. And, you know, our world has been so transformed since the inception of the European project. We have moved at that time from the post-war period, we have moved very quickly into this infotech world of immediate communication.
Mm-hmm.
Its DNA, part of its DNA, is the globalizing process,
mm-hmm.
which impacts even on the most intimate and personal dimensions of our lives and our personal lives and our families and so forth, how we work and so forth. And so I believe this universal call that is a characteristic of the Christian tradition of recognizing the dignity of each woman and man as being made and created in the image of God, that is something which has, I believe, intense and new implications for us in our time. The question is, how do we develop a social ethical policy and politic capable of responding to these challenges that are now facing us in terms of achieving justice, which is the bedrock for peace? Because without justice, we have seen this in Northern Ireland, without a just society based on principles of that you have espoused since the inception of the United States, of the freedom and human rights of all and the equality of all, one will never achieve either peace or justice. It's difficult.
It is difficult.
Yeah.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and Mike Brady will join our conversation as we continue here. Bishop Noel Traynor, the current bishop of the Diocese of Down and Connor in Northern Ireland, is with us. He's going to be the celebrant of the Liturgy for Peace and Justice on Sunday, August 21st, on the Irish Fest grounds. We started with the Brexit vote because he worked for a number of years with the Commission of the Bishops' Conferences of the European Communities, Secretary General in Brussels, to project Christian values to the European process. We'll have other areas we'll be talking about, and peace and justice will be a large part of the upcoming conversation. And we'll be talking about Irish Fest tomorrow, too. We're going to have musicians in our studio. We're going to have an Irish wolfhound in our studio. Maybe even two Irish wolfhounds. I am very excited about this. And more. So we'll celebrate Irish culture tomorrow. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, if you'd like to go there and leave messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bishop Traynor will, as we said, be leading the Mass, the liturgy for peace and justice on Sunday. Michael Brady is also joining us in our studios here in Milwaukee. Mike has been working on Irish Fest, and also he has been serving as co-president of the Milwaukee Ulster Project. He's worked with that organization for a number of years, as our family has as well. So I thought we would introduce him. He brought the bishop to us, and thank you very much, Mike, and Mike, for doing that. And that's a big part of, I mean, it's something that's emphasized, I know, in previous Irish Fest, because there is a troubled history in Northern Ireland, particularly, and the Ulster Project has done work for years and years and years now to take on that issue.
Yeah, for almost 40 years now, we've been bringing young people, 15, 16 years of age, to Milwaukee from Northern Ireland, and 12 to 16 young people, both Protestant and Catholic, and it's been a very good experience as well for the American teens and the American families that host them. Program has been going on for almost 40 years now, so it certainly has been very well received, and I think there's probably 25 cities across the country that
25 now
that
wow.
do a similar type of program.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it was started when the troubles were pretty significant in Northern Ireland.
Correct. Back in I think 1980, 1979, it was started. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I have heard, maybe you have stories about this, but people have really risen to important and influential positions in Irish government and other organizations working toward peace and reconciliation as a result of being in the Ulster Project when they were 16 years old.
Correct. I don't have the names of the people, but yes, I've heard the same kinds of reports too, that from among the 150 or 200 young people that come over every year to the United States, and that they've been able to go back and look at their community, look at Northern Ireland, look at the world in a different way, and that's been very enlightening, as well as it's been for the American teens here, too.
Mm-hmm. So I know that are people who have participated in the Ulster Project will be at the Mass on Sunday morning, too. They usually go.
They will. They will be bringing the gifts up at the offertory, yes. Yeah. Yes, as they always do, yes.
So how did you find Bishop Traynor? How did you persuade him to come to Milwaukee?
Work with Father Mike Maher, who's a Jesuit and who's been involved in Irish Fest. And so we thought for the 36th year, we thought it was important to bring somebody over from Northern Ireland. And we were delighted that he was able to join us this year. Yeah.
Good. Thanks, Mike, for all you've done. You have an interesting background, Bishop Traynor, because you were born in the Republic, although just very close to Northern Ireland. So you must be this sort of citizen of the whole island in a way, right? That's an interesting to be born in the Republic, and now you're bishop in counties in Northern Ireland. Do you have a picture of the whole, do you think, because of that?
Well, let's hope so. But I was born in, as I said, in County Monaghan, which is one of the three counties in the historic province of Ulster, now in the Republic of Ireland.
Mm.
Six counties in Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. and three of the remaining counties, Donegal, Cavan, and Monaghan, in the Republic of Ireland. And I grew up outside the town of Monaghan, in an area which, and in a town which, as I was growing up, was confessionally a mosaic, very mixed. We had Church of Ireland, we had Presbyterian congregations, we had the Methodists, we had some Baptists, we had Plymouth Brethren. And so a reflection, at least in terms of Western Christendom, pretty much of the mosaic of the Christian tradition and churches. Relations were always very positive and good there. My next-door neighbors as I was growing up, the Brakey family lived in the local Church of Ireland rectory. They piled into my dad's car in the morning to drive into town with us to school, and we came back with their father, heaven rest him, Jack. And, of course, they have remained, as many of our neighbors have, wonderful friends and people who have been of immense support to me personally and throughout life. Then, one studied in the Republic of Ireland, and in due course, I moved. I worked for a short time as a curate in the diocese in which I was incarnated or licensed as a priest called Clocher. It's on the border. Half of it lies in Northern Ireland and half in the Republic of Ireland. Again, a diocese running pretty much from the west of the country to the east. Quite mixed in terms of its confessional identity, with in its western regions a place of pilgrimage called the Purgatory of St. Patrick, or Lough Derg, which became a place of pilgrimage for people from continental Europe as of around the year 1129. And there are all kinds of pieces of evidence in manuscript form recounting the journeys of various people, the most interesting of them perhaps a mercenary Hungarian knight who, having fought for many years in Italy and in various local wars, decided that he should mend his ways and betook himself to Compostela, you know, in Galicia, in the west of Spain, north of Portugal, to Compostela. Finding himself there, he thought the place rather noisy and, you might say, contaminated with all kinds of peddlers and people selling all kinds of wares. And whilst there, heard of this place in the Western Isles on the perimeter, on the edge of the known world. This was in the 14th century before the discovery of the New World. And he writes then an account of his travels through the kingdoms of England and Ireland to get to this place, known by Dante, of course, and referred to by Dante in his trilogy, but in the section, the Il Purgatorio, and goes there and spends, as pilgrims did in that time, a night in this cave, locked with a stone, believing that if he survived the night, he would be assured of eternal life. But, I mean, this is a theme of, it's a place still of pilgrimage, where people go for 3 days anyway, and where an ecumenical service is held once a year. But then I worked for a short time in that diocese, both in the south and later in the north of Ireland, before I was then transferred to work with this commission of the bishops' conferences of the member states of the European Union. In other words, it's a commission made up of bishops which meet twice a year, and they try, from a faith perspective, to follow and to understand the development of European Union policy in areas such as social policy, research policy, matters pertaining to legal affairs and constitutional affairs. Also, indeed, in more recent years, of course, following the question of promoting dialogue between different cultural traditions in the world, and specifically between Islam and the West. That was a significant vector of my work. But coming back to then returning to Northern Ireland in 2008, when I was nominated Bishop of Down and Connor. Down and Connor is a diocese which is in the northeast. It's the northeastern corner of the island of Ireland. We have a small island called Rathlin in the North Sea, and then we have all of County Antrim, which is the Connor section. And interestingly, this morning, Mike and I were visiting your wonderful art museum here in
Milwaukee. Oh, isn't it great? Yes.
Which is an architectural gem, and in terms of its paintings and its exhibits, fascinating place. Alas, I was only able to spend a short hour and a half in it. But whilst there, in wandering around the room, I noticed this beautiful map of, you might say, the British Isles. At least you had Scotland, England and Wales on it, and a section of Northern Ireland, a map produced in Amsterdam at the end of the 1600s. And on that map, down in the left-hand corner, there was this corner of Northern Ireland indicating County Antrim. And on it, there were three or four places of interest indicated. A castle in the on the north coast, Dunluce, the town of Antrim. Belfast was not marked. Why? Because it didn't exist at that time, at the end of the 1600s. And then this little dot, Connor. And Connor is a little hamlet with a few houses, and nowadays an Anglican church on a beautiful promontory, a beautiful hillock, which was clearly a medieval ecclesiastical site. So anyway, I came to Down and Connor in 2008, and it is, from the point of view of the landscape, a beautiful part of the world. You have the glens of Antrim, the mountains of Mourne in County Down. In terms of its population, a very interesting sociologically and in terms of in socio-religious terms, a very interesting diocese in which to work and to cooperate with so many people within the Catholic Church and within the other churches and within other faith traditions. I say that because our perception, and indeed oftentimes the discussion in Northern Ireland and the perception from outside, is of some kind of binary society. Either you're Catholic or you're Protestant. But the reality is that over the last 5 or 6 decades, peoples from different cultural backgrounds have immigrated. Yes, they're minorities, but the test of any society and the test of any civilization is its capacity, A, to be aware of, B, to respect, and thirdly, to promote the identity of its minorities and to appreciate their contribution. And this is something we have to learn to do as a society. So we're no longer simply, if you like, a two-pillar or two-column society. We're no longer a binary society. We are indeed a reflection of this globalizing world, because among us not only do you find, you know, people of the Catholic tradition, of the Anglican and Reformed traditions, you also find many people of the Orthodox traditions. We have a Romanian Orthodox population. We have an Antiochian Orthodox Church. We have the Coptic tradition. More recently, in the last 20 years, the numbers of people from Kerala and India has increased. People working in the information infotech society, in hospitals and so forth. And as well as that, of course, we have a small Islamic community. And we have, of course, some people from the Buddhist tradition. And we also have, intriguingly, some Christians from China, including Catholics, involved in various service industries. So I say these are small numbers. I mean, they are absolutely small in your terms. But as I say, they make up the new mosaic of Northern Ireland. And this, of course, has immense implications for our political future. And indeed for our cultural future. How will all the organizations, agencies, and institutions of our society, established for so long, how will they be impacted by this diversity of presence, by this enriching presence? That too, like Brexit, is uncharted territory, but will certainly be a great adventure, I hope, of imagination and of understanding to chart in the years ahead.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Bishop Noel Traynor is our guest. He is the Bishop of the Diocese of Down and Connor in Northern Ireland. And Nan in Madison is our first caller for you. Hi, Nan.
Hello.
Hi, Nan. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm trying to understand this issue about Brexit and immigration. Is the European Union telling England and Ireland and Scotland that they have to accept X number of immigrants, and they're resisting that and want to make up their own number? Or I don't quite understand that.
Okay. Yeah, this is a, you're touching on a very, good afternoon to you. You're touching on a very, sensitive issue. As you know, there are thousands upon thousands of migrants from the Middle East and from Africa, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, making their way towards the European frontiers. These people are fleeing wars, they are fleeing famine, they are fleeing penury, they are fleeing situations where human rights are not respected. They are coming towards Europe in the hope of finding a new life. You have followed that story and that terrible saga, the tragedies of the loss of life. You have followed people making their way, once reaching land, whether in Greece or in Italy, making their way by and large northwards, often and on different routes, trying to head oftentimes in the direction of Germany or Sweden, or indeed towards the United Kingdom. Now, the second point I would make is, here you, the question of your specific question, this question raises the relationship between member states of the European Union and the European Union itself as a political entity. And in this arena of shared response, the shared competence, what we are trying to do, or what the European Union is trying to do, is to develop some kind of humanitarian resolution and humanitarian formula whereby these people might be, in one way or another, either received or accommodated in terms of the capacity of the European Union and its member states to take on, to bring people into their countries. Why do I say that? I say it because, of course, each member state has, as I mentioned earlier in the interview, has problems of rising unemployment, of different levels of performance of their economy, mm-hmm. and also the problem of providing for the welfare state, which has to be paid for, of course, from public taxes. So all of these issues enter the fray in trying to develop a means of responding to this great need of our time. And a formula, a satisfactory formula, has not yet been produced. To the extent that some people, on the one hand, say, well, we are developing a fortress Europe. We're building walls and building fences, as some countries have done. Other people saying, this is the single great, you might say, humanitarian crisis of our time and the single greatest social ethical challenge of our time. Clearly, given the level of expectations in terms of social welfare, in terms of employment for upcoming generations and our children, this is not a matter that is easily of resolution. And hence, we have seen all kinds of debates about proposed solutions, including the arrangement with Turkey and so forth. Mm-hmm. I don't pretend to you that this is an easy question to resolve. It is not, but it is one which I believe, in terms of the welfare of the human family and the plight of those who are fleeing these countries, that we have a responsibility to work very hard to try and find some way of accommodating people who absolutely have to flee from their homes with their children.
As you know, you walked into a city where there have been some violent protests over the last weekend concerning some of the very issues that you described, with people, migrants trying to find their way into Europe, poverty, extreme poverty, schools not very good, no jobs, just a real different, segregated, isolated community from a larger Milwaukee, very segregated here. I'm wondering about the European Union's commitment to, and if there are any policies that we can learn as to how to integrate people from the communities who are coming from these very countries where they've had great war, who may be of a different faith. How do we integrate them? How do you integrate them in Northern Ireland? Is there some country that we can look to as a model of, I know it's a thorny problem, but here's the common good. Here's what we need to do.
Yes. I'm not sure that anybody has found the answer to this. In France, for example, the situation is such that on the one side you find places where people are reasonably well integrated, but you find massive areas of ghettoization and segregation in many cities. Mm-hmm. Looking at many other countries, you find similar situations. This has come about over decades for all kinds of reasons. Ethnic groups moving out of a part of the city, improving their lot, other groups moving in. How do we tackle this question? Well, I think that the root, not to speak of an answer, but the root and the route map must include some kind of interdisciplinary cooperative effort on the part of public, private, and I would say third sector, by that I mean voluntary organizations, including the faiths. Because at least in the West, we have had, since the end of the 18th century, of course, this process of secularization, which in itself is not unhealthy, but it has led to the total privatization of faith and the religious factor in society. And if people of different ethnic, cultural, and religious backgrounds and traditions are to live together in peace and in harmony, and not only in peace and harmony, but cooperatively, clearly there must be some base somewhere for promoting interreligious and intercultural encounter right. and dialogue and understanding. Now, that is not possible, clearly, unless in terms of, for example, educational policy, we look at how we educate our own children in the vocabulary of their different cultural and religious traditions. And similarly, ensure that ethnic groups which enter our countries, you know, are doing the same in a non-ideological fashion. And we, I believe, at the level then of trying to devise modes and sort of formulae and ways of integrating people, this clearly involves everything from urban planning to, I would say, educational policy, and to work on the part of faiths, whatever their configuration, be they church, be they synagogue, be they meeting place, be they mosque, that they make a commitment to engage in encounter. This is something which in Northern Ireland we are also attempting, in that we have a very small embryonic inter-religious forum bringing together the different faiths represented in our territory. We also have obviously a council of dialogue and encounter between Christians and Jews. These are still embryonic, but they are instruments which I am delighted to know exist, and which I personally believe are most important to support and encourage in their work, because I believe they carry with them elements, essential elements of the recipe to deal with the kind of issues which we thought we had solved.
Yeah, we did.
But alas, we had not. And that brings me back to the publications of one that I don't wish to misrepresent, but nonetheless of Samuel Huntington in the early 90s, when he began to talk about a clash of civilizations. Mm. We still have to work very hard to ensure that our generation is one which avoids that.
Mm-hmm. We welcome more phone calls. We're speaking this hour with the current bishop of the Diocese of Down and Connor in Northern Ireland. He's in Milwaukee to be the celebrant of the Liturgy for Peace and Justice this Sunday at Irish Fest. And he also has a very strong connection to the European Union, because he worked for a number of years with the Commission of the Bishops, Conferences of the European Communities, as Secretary General, and he was in Brussels to project Christian values to the European process. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. We have a few more minutes to entertain some of your calls, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming phone calls for Bishop Traynor. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we go to Joe in Delafield next. Hi, Joe.
How are you? And Bishop Traynor, I just encourage you, and I know that you're very conscious of staying out of other countries' politics, and I appreciate that. But one thing that transcends politics, and that's the importance in the United States for stressing the consistent ethic for life from the earliest stages of life right through natural death. And one thing that has concerned me for many decades is the prevalence and persistence of the death penalty in the United States. And every so often you'll hear noises in states that don't have the death penalty of bringing it back. And I think, you know, that would be a tragedy. And I encourage you to talk to your brother bishops about this. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe, very much for your call. Susan in Milwaukee. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. I just want to thank the bishop and you for having him on your show. I'm grateful. I think it's really so needed to have this interfaith dialogue going, and I just encourage that people are listening, get involved, do something so that we can have one world, as we know that that's what the divine wants from us.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks very much for the call. Elaine in Wautoma is next. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I have a question, and I don't know if this is correct or not, but I have heard that once the European Union was formed, a lot of the laws of each nation were no longer enacted by the government of that country. It was enacted by some people that made all the laws for all the countries. Is that correct?
Thank you for your question. That's a very helpful question, and I'm delighted to receive it. It is a most important matter you raise, because this confusion, if I may say so, is quite prevalent, even sometimes in member states of the European Union. And that's why I mentioned the word competence at an earlier stage. Now, to answer your question, a significant number of directives, regulations have been evolved by the European Union and its institutions. I mentioned three key institutions: the Commission, the European Commission, the European Council and the Council of Ministers, and also the directly elected European Parliament. Okay? Now, the European Union only drafts and makes policy in areas where it has either direct competence or some kind of shared or subsidiary competence. In all areas, and this is a most important thing to understand, I use this very simplistic image, if you like, and if I may, of the European Commission needing the ball. So they decide, it is decided that we need some piece of legislation of whatever kind in a particular area to ensure the quality of something or other, okay? Once that ball is put together and needed, it is thrown, as it were, to those who represent the national governments. If the matter pertains to agriculture, it's the ministers of agriculture. If it's fisheries, the minister of fisheries. If it's communications, the ministers in the member states, the national governments responsible for communications. It is also sent to the European Parliament, where you have members of the parliament directly elected by the populations of the now 28 member states. These three institutions are all involved in developing this piece of legislation, which sometimes takes a long time. So in that sense, at all stages, the member states are represented directly by those whom they elect, the members of the European Parliament, men and women, now over 700 of them. And of course, these people who are working in the institutions, be it of the Commission or of the member state or of the European Council, are nationals of the member states. As well as that, keeping an eye on this process, you have those civil servants and diplomats working in the representation, the permanent representation of each country to the European Union, who champion the national interest. And the community method that I mentioned to you is the process by which, at one and the same time, the common interest of all member states together is conjugated with the particular interests of the member states, as guaranteed by those directly elected, above all in the European Parliament, and of course those in the national representations. A significant volume of law and policy is, yes, evolved by these institutions in the way I have mentioned to you. But there are areas where the European Union does not have any competence and therefore does not produce legislation. And one of them refers back to an area mentioned by the previous caller, namely the area of life, human life. That, though, is complex, because sometimes decisions of the European Court of Justice can impact one way or another, but it is, that is an area of what's called national competence. So this is why I talked about this institution being a very new thing. It is something that resides between the national and the international. It is the decision, free decision, of member states to come together to generate the public good for all their citizens, and in the area of peace, in the area of building infrastructure, roads and all kinds of infrastructure, in the area of social welfare, in the area of, yes, one can also say education, all kinds of programs and projects have been put together which have enhanced the life of citizens of the member states of the European Union immensely over its now more than 60 years of existence.
As we have 30 seconds, Patty, can you talk in 30 seconds? Hi.
Thank you, Bishop, for coming to Milwaukee.
Thank you.
My family and I had the privilege of visiting Belfast a month ago. Mm. And if anyone is in the unique position to talk about peace, it's the people of Belfast and what they have tried to come together to rebuild a beautiful city.
Yeah, it is a beautiful city. Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For the call. What time is the Mass on Sunday?
9:30
9:30
Gates open at 8 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Okay. All right. That's
great.
What we have to say.
Thanks,
about
Kathleen.
That. Thanks, Mike. Bishop Noel Treanor, he's going to be delivering the Liturgy for Peace and Justice at Irish Fest this coming Sunday, August 21st, when the skies are going to be sunny and the day is going to be beautiful. We'll be with you again tomorrow, and we'll be talking about 1791. It's an amazing story. You have to listen for hour number one. Hour number two is our annual Irish Fest show, so we'll have some fun and music and poetry and all of that coming up the second hour of the show. Thanks to Scotty Meyer for producing this show and to Scotty for on-air production.